This week on the Best of Public Radio, NHPR partners with the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Dr. Willie Shih was the featured speaker recently. A professor of management practice at Harvard Business School, Shih also co-authored the book Restoring American Competitiveness. Today, he offers his perspective on the recent increase in American manufacturing.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for the invitation to speak with you today. Now, to motivate this, I need to start with some background. I'd gotten to the Harvard Business School just before the start of the Great Recession, when things started falling apart for the economy in September 2008. One of the questions that was asked a lot around the school during the subsequent months, when factories were laying off people left and right, was, does the U.S. have a competitiveness problem? Now, I should start out by saying that, what do we mean by competitiveness? If American companies are doing great, but wages are falling, the dollar is cheap, or jobs are being cut, that's not a sign of American competitiveness. That's actually a sign we're uncompetitive. Now, if American workers are getting higher and higher wages, but American companies are unable to compete globally, that's not a sign of competitiveness either. To be competitive, you have to have customers and companies and employees all happy. There's only one way to do that, which is to get more or better outputs from a given set of inputs, which means you have to constantly be more productive. Now, many would say that over the long run, increasing productivity should be the central goal of economic policy. In that respect, America is competitive if our businesses can be so productive that they can compete globally, but also support high wages and a good standard of living. Now, let's look at some statistics. If you looked at the rolling 10-year compound annual growth rate in U.S. private non-farm employees, it's been pretty stable at around 2% per annum from 1991 to 2001. Our great job machine could be counted on to produce job growth every year. But starting in 2001, that rate began a steep decline and crossed into negative territory in 2009. Now, that suggests there was some structural problem here that actually started before the Great Recession. You can get some insight into what happened by distinguishing between industries that are exposed to international competition, things like machine tools, electronics, automobiles, versus industries that serve local markets, like your hairdresser or the restaurant down the street. The economists, and I should say I'm not one of them, but the economists refer to these as tradable sectors versus non-tradable. I refer to them that way now, too. That's what happens when you hang around with too many economists. Okay. Tradable goods are ones that you can produce somewhere and ship somewhere else to be consumed. They don't need to be produced locally. So non-tradable goods need to be produced locally. Like I said, cars, iPhones, apple juice, ibuprofen, these are all tradable. Haircuts, restaurant meals, most healthcare work, ready-mix concrete. These aren't tradable. Ready-mix concrete, you have to use it within a certain amount of time after you prepare it. Now, when I last had a CAT scan of my head, now I know you don't do these things routinely, but the last time I had my head CAT scanned, the radiologist who read the x-ray was in New Zealand, right? So that kind of medical care has become tradable. And when you drive up to some McDonald's drive-thrus and order at the speaker, the person taking your order might be several states away in a call center. Okay, so even that's tradable these days. Well, since 1990, almost all job growth in this country has been in the non-tradable sectors. Oh, and there's been a lot of job growth in the government sector, our tax dollars at work, but there have been almost no net jobs added in industries that have been exposed to international competition. Okay, another set of interesting statistics. In 1950, manufacturing contributed 31% to our GDP, and it made up 27% of our workforce. By 2010, it was down to 12% of GDP and 9% of the workforce. Should we worry about this? Well, again, many of the economists around me say, well, this is just like agriculture. As a nation develops, its productivity increases as farmers substitute more capital for labor. That's just like our little small-scale farming operation up the road here. My wife, Julie, is the principal source of labor since I'm around much less. So since we don't have a lot of labor, anytime we can substitute capital to solve a problem, we're going to do it. That's why our now defunct John Deere dealer liked us so much, I should mention. But anyways, this is actually much more than a policy debate. I would argue that for the past two decades, American companies have increasingly chosen to source production outside the U.S., either through what's called FDI, or foreign direct investment, in other words, offshoring to their own factories abroad in a low-cost country like China, or through outsourcing to somebody who will do that. In fact, I think what really got this going was 9/11, because after 9/11, there was a severe economic downturn that followed those attacks, and a lot of people in manufacturing industries had to get rid of capacity and cut their expenses just to make their numbers. And if you look at how they did it, they closed their factories here or sold off their manufacturing operations and got those assets off their books. Now, I mentioned this notion of tradability and the tradable sector. Well, the offshoring boom rode on top of the opening up of China and a massive increase in the supply of available labor on a global basis. So, for example, around the year 2000, when I was working at Kodak in Rochester, New York, the fully burdened labor cost in the factory, which means salary plus benefits, was probably about 10 to 20 times what it was in southern China. So in the late 1990s, we saw the beginnings of a boom in what the economists call labor arbitrage, moving the work to a place like China to exploit the labor cost differential, which is possible to do with a tradable product or service. And this labor arbitrage really took off in 2001. Now, what was the mentality of labor arbitrage? Well, let's do the math. Let's say 50% of my product cost is labor. If I can cut that 50% by, say, 90%, I can either make much more profit or I can lower my selling price to win business away from my competitors, or both. Granted, it'll cost something to ship the finished product back to me, but that's usually a small percentage of the total cost. Well, in the late 1990s and early 2000s, there was also a vast expansion of low-cost containerized freight. Innovations like double-stack trains, huge container ships, and big upgrades to container ports in places like Hong Kong and Shanghai and Shenzhen and Qingdao and Tianjin, across Korea, Singapore, elsewhere. By the way, I should say, this kind of arbitrage is not new. When the textile industry moved out of New England to the South and then offshore, it was exactly the same thing. Technology has repeatedly increased the size of the tradable sector. First, it was the railroad, then steamships, containerization, low-cost communications, and the internet. Actually, if you look at the collapse of manufacturing around the New York Harbor area in the 1960s and early 1970s, it was really caused by container shipping. It allowed all those manufacturers who used to be located along the docks of Manhattan and Brooklyn and on the Jersey side, it allowed them to move inland to New Jersey or Pennsylvania. And of course, communications and internet enabled that McDonald's to use a call center for its drive-thru. You know, the person at the remote call center usually snaps a picture of you in your car and posts your picture and your order to a screen at the pickup window, so people in the restaurant can then focus on getting the food prepared. So this discussion on tradability actually helps us with a broader take on what makes a country's manufacturing competitive in the global economy. I say it's the ability of workers at all levels in a given country to attract the means of production to create value. Means of production means financial capital, the organizational capital, and the technology. Needless to say, globally, the competition for these means of production is intense. You know, financial capital can move around the world with a click of a mouse these days, and companies can arbitrage labor cost and productivity differences on a global basis through FDI, foreign direct investment, or outsourcing. Okay, so that's some background on tradability. Now I want to give you some more personal background because it leads to how we came up to some of the thinking that we're currently working on. I've now been at the Harvard Business School for 7.5 years. Before that, I spent 28 years in industry. Most of them were in the computer industry with IBM and others, but the last 10 were in consumer electronics and media, where I ran the consumer digital operations at Kodak until 2003, when they decided that they really would rather be yet another printer company. Most of those years were spent making and selling products, like large-scale supercomputer systems at Silicon Graphics that would sell for hundreds of thousands, actually tens of millions of dollars. Of course, my next job was at Kodak, where I instantly jumped to selling optical discs for 30 cents each. That was kind of a big change. Now, most of you who have real jobs can probably appreciate what life at work is like, you know, particularly when your firm is going through an existential crisis. Of course, those types of jobs are more interesting, but they do have their share of challenges. My days were mostly spent lurching from problem to problem. Sometimes we had crises that were kind of multi-year. Sometimes they were existential crises. But all the challenges came up on a regular basis, and with those came a lot of interesting questions. The only problem is you're so busy addressing all these crises, we never had time to think, is like, why was that? Some of the questions were really interesting. For example, I had 3 factories in one of the Kodak business units that reported to me. One was located in New York, one was in Guadalajara, Mexico, and the third was in Ireland, in this coastal town east of Cork. What was interesting about these three factories is they used identical tools, you know, if you're a manufacturing guy, you think of those as the machines you use. So we used identical tools. They all supposedly used identically the same manufacturing processes, and they all made identically the same product, right down to the tear strip on the product, you know, on the cellophane packaging. So yet the outcomes from all of these factories were all completely different. They had different manufacturing yields, they had different costs. Everything is different. It's like, how could that be? Of course, you know, so we solved the problem. We didn't have time to research why that was. Another question is, one of those questions, I worked for 3 different computer companies, IBM and Digital Equipment and Silicon Graphics. And though I would have never admitted it at the time, you know, frankly, we sold more or less the same product to more or less the same customers. Yet the companies were all completely different. Different in how they designed things, how they sold them. Different when you walked in the lobby in terms of how the place felt, how the people dressed, how they talked, how they ran meetings, just how everything felt. Why was that? And then there was the question of the boundary between product design and manufacturing. Back in my days at IBM in the 1980s, I spent the entire decade of the 1980s at IBM. I really learned the value of having production close to design. When I was a director of workstation development down at IBM's Austin, Texas site, our manufacturing line was right across the street. And I saw a lot of value in that. I remember there was a time when I was talking to the manufacturing line manager, and he was complaining about some of the stuff my engineers did from a design standpoint. And he said, you know, the reason our yields are so bad is because your engineers don't design stuff in a way that we can make it. Of course, that led to my suggestion. It's like, okay, why don't we take our teams and change jobs for a day? So we took all my engineers down, put them on the production floor. I ran the wave solder machine. Needless to say, we had to throw out everything we made that day. Okay. But the point was, it made a difference when the people were close and they talked and worked together. In fact, I would assert that this is what the Japanese automakers taught the big three in the 1980s when they really cleaned their clocks. It took some of the Detroit guys a decade or two to figure that out. But the point was that a lot of innovation happened on the manufacturing line close to where product development was done. In fact, a lot of academics studied this problem back in the 1980s. My friend, the late Michael Dirtuzos, who was then head of the lab for computer sciences at MIT, chaired this competitiveness commission at that time, and they spent a great deal of effort understanding how the Japanese automakers had stolen a march on the big three from Detroit. And their 1989 report, which was Made in America, Regaining the Productive Edge, cited our technological weakness in development and production. They said, and I'll quote, "The United States is still arguably the leader in basic research. The scale of its scientific enterprises is unequaled, and is second to none in making new discoveries. Yet U.S. companies increasingly find themselves lagging behind their foreign rivals in the commercial exploitation of inventions and discoveries. Sound familiar? Japanese companies like Toyota and Honda taught us how much innovation actually happened on the production line and how important it was to keep that close to development. Kim Clark and Takahiro Fujimoto at Harvard Business School at that time talked about this then as well. They wrote, and I'll quote again, "The speed of product development is strongly influenced by the links between problem-solving cycles, and that successful linking requires direct personal contact across functions, liaison roles at each unit, cross-functional task forces, cross-functional project teams and systems, product manager is integrator." But then in the late 1990s, we saw the beginning of this huge wave of offshoring. So my third big question, and we talked about this a lot in Rochester, was why was that? Did something change? Right, so since coming to the Harvard Business School, it's not that I have a leisurely existence, but it's given me the opportunity to go back and look at these questions. They even gave me a research budget to go explore these things, which was nice. And one of my colleagues, upon observing all this, said, "You know, Willie, you actually always were an academic. You just did a 28-year field experiment, and you're a little slow interpreting the data." Okay, and that's actually, I think that's actually a very good characterization. But let me come back to this third question, because that is really at the heart of the discussion today. What happened? Did we forget the value of keeping production close to product development? Well, no. Like I said, I think the 2001 downturn in the China World Trade Organization, the China WTO accession, triggered this massive growth in labor arbitrage. And I think this is how companies made their numbers. But if you happen to have a 10x or 20x labor cost differential, even if the offshore people were not qualified, you would just use more of them, right? The saying at that time was, throw labor at the problem. And there was something else interesting that went on at the same time. Whereas in the US or Western Europe, you might use a lot of complex automation because of the high labor cost in China, it was cheaper to use people than machines. I actually remember visiting a Taiwan manufacturer of personal computer motherboards back in the early 1990s, and he was telling me about his cost, and he said, "See that machine? That's called an SMT machine. It stands for surface mount technology. It's one of these machines that put electronic components on a circuit board." He said, "Way too expensive. They cost $100,000 each." I said, "So what are you going to do?" He said, "Ah, we have this new technology." Okay, we go over to China, we hire all these young girls, and they put everything on the board by hand. We call it HMT, for hand mount technology. I've actually seen this. It's really amazing, right? But anyway, so after outsourcing or offshoring your production, how do you coordinate between product design and manufacturing? Well, we had another saying those days. It was, fill the sky with planes, right? If you were in product development, you spent a lot of time flying to China. If you work for Apple today in product development, you're going to spend a good part of your life there. That's how you, quote, design it in California and make it in China. And they used to make it in Fremont, California. Now it's Shanghai or Shenzhen or Shenzhou or Chengdu in China. By the way, that's how I got 5 million frequent flyer miles. I used to go over 15 or 18 times a year, but you know, I was by no means the worst on this. So then, is this a problem? That's really the question. I mean, once again, the economists say trade is the way everyone can specialize in what they are best at, and then trade benefits everyone. So should the U.S., you know, the economists say, well, we'll make up for it with the export of services and innovation. The problem is, if you look at the numbers on our trade deficit, the deficit created by the import of manufactured goods is far larger than we can ever hope to pay for with the export of services. It's even worse if you look at individual sectors like high technology inputs. Okay, so now back to Willie's field experiment. Back in July 1997, I arrived in Rochester, New York to run Kodak's nascent consumer digital business. And when I get there, the engineers say, well, Willie, we understand labor costs are really high, so we built this highly automated factory in Rochester to make sure that labor costs weren't going to be a problem. But you know what? We couldn't make cameras in Rochester. And why was that? Well, there were a couple of things. Long, long ago, when Kodak was mainly a photographic film and photo finishing company, Kodak made cameras. And then, probably about the mid-60s, some brilliant consultant, probably trained at the Harvard Business School, pointed out to them, is like, you know what? You make all of your money in film. You make none of the money in cameras. So if you get rid of the cameras, you're going to make more money. That's true, right? So guess what? They got out of the camera business, basically ceded that to Japan, to companies like Nikon and Canon and Minolta, Ricoh. I remember one of the presidents of one of those camera companies telling me, you know, Willie, in the film era, Kodak made all the money. We made no money. It's like, yeah, that was the design. Well, you know, Kodak's profits rose. And in the beginning of the 70s, there was a time when, believe it or not, Kodak had the largest market cap of any stock on the New York Stock Exchange. Fabulously profitable company. Well, Rochester was the optics capital of the world for a while. That's partly because of companies like Kodak, but it also spawned companies like Xerox and Bausch & Lomb and others. But when Kodak stopped making and sourcing optical components, all that infrastructure kind of atrophied. Another thing happened in parallel in the 60s and 70s. The consumer electronics manufacturers, that was viewed as mature, so they moved like television manufacturing offshore to these little-known companies like Sony or Matsushita or Sanyo or people like that. Those companies, of course, went on to pioneer things like camcorders, which used electronic image sensors. And of course, as those electronics went portable, they did things like the Walkman personal music player. They had to invest in the development of batteries. In fact, there was a researcher at the University of Texas at Austin who invented all the fundamental technology associated with lithium-ion batteries, but he couldn't find anybody in the U.S. who would be interested in licensing the technology, so he ended up licensing it to Sony. Okay, so back in Rochester, it turns out the most important things you needed to understand to make a digital camera are things like, gee, electronic sensors and kind of the multi-element zoom lens barrels and lens molding and polishing, and how do I vacuum deposit coatings on the lenses, and I need to make viewfinders and shutters and rechargeable batteries. All of the things that were unimportant in the film era suddenly became important. That was kind of a key insight. It was almost as if all the complementary assets, the complementary technical know-how and manufacturing capabilities that are embodied in your component supplier network, your tool and equipment providers, your human resources, the engineers, the scientists, the technicians, the institutions that train them, even your competitors, they had withered away. To me, it was just like Gareth Harding's famous 1968 paper on the tragedy of the commons. You know, in the olden days, the commons was that communal pasture available to all the farmers for the animals to graze. And the tragedy occurred when individuals acting in their own self-interest behaved contrary to the long-term investments of a wider group, in this case by overgrazing. Well, this was like an industrial commons, which was the term that we coined at that point, and it was through neglect from firms who offshored and dried up the business of their local supplier networks and made them non-viable. Back to Kodak, I took a trip to Japan and went up to the Nagano area, and sure enough, there you found a whole supplier network of firms who made everything you needed to make a digital camera. And if you had a problem, you pick up the phone and somebody would be there in 20 minutes. Okay, needless to say, we had to move our digital camera development over there. We bought a company and that became the foundation of our efforts. But that need to keep R&D close to manufacturing, that was a worrying sign. In this case, we moved R&D out of the US. Now, the next thing that happened at Kodak, I was put in charge of this group that was trying to commercialize a new type of display. One of the scientists there, Cheng Tang, made a fundamental discovery on an organic electroluminescence. Actually, his job was to make organic solar cells, you know, light in, electricity out, and he screwed up. You know, he came up with this device where you put electricity in and light comes out. Okay, but anyways, if you have a Samsung Galaxy S smartphone, that's the type of display you have. Okay, so all that technology originated at Kodak. Well, what was the problem? In order to produce a display like this, you had to deposit these organic chemical layers on top of a sheet of glass that had this layer of silicon deposited on it and then annealed with a laser. that process for making something that's called low-temperature polysilicon, or LTPS, really only existed in Japan and Asia because since the U.S. had given up the TV business and the display business, all of that had moved over to Asia. So we obviously had to move our R&D for that over there as well. So that raised the broader question of, does it even make sense to invest in some areas of R&D when you can't sustain it by doing the manufacturing here anymore? Now, some might say, well, that's what I would expect when an industrial cluster goes away. The distinction here is that while a cluster might be a related group of suppliers and industries, a commons often transcends a cluster. So, for example, if you look at what's going on in the San Francisco Bay Area right now, the largest semiconductor toolmaker is moving all of its production out of the Bay Area to Singapore and Asia because that's where its customers are. Okay. They were one of the largest consumers of precision machining in the Bay Area, you know, so that whole capability is starting to have questionable viability, which has a huge impact on the defense industry in that same area, in the same geographic area. Or if you look in the Midwest, one of the things that I've noted is kind of the offshoring of metal parts, particularly castings and forgings. You know, if you want to make a 500-ton forging in the U.S., you can't do it anymore. You have to go to Korea or China or France or Russia. And, you know, I was talking to a maker of offshore oil drilling platforms down in Texas, and he says, well, he has to get all his large forgings from Korea. By the way, the Koreans are making offshore oil platforms now, and so are the Chinese. Okay, so back to electronic displays. You know, the first Amazon Kindle, I don't know how many of you had one of those. It had this electronic paper display, the one you might remember that had the black type on the white screen. That actually had exactly the same problem as the OLED displays that I talked about earlier. You know, they used this invention that came out of the MIT Media Lab, and there was this spin-off company called E-Ink that was commercializing it. But they needed the same low-temperature polysilicon displays, so they had to go to Asia for that. I remember interviewing the president of their supplier in Taiwan, and he said, you know, I'm waiting for these guys to go under so I can buy them, right? He eventually did buy them, you know, and took the name E-Ink. So if you go over to Cambridge and look at E-Ink, which was the inventor of the Kindle display, it's a Taiwanese company now, and more of the work, of course, is moving over there. Now, Kodak eventually sold all its OLED patents to the Korean company LG, right? So you can see how this story kind of plays out. Let's stay with the Amazon Kindle for a moment. Well, I like taking things apart, and if you look inside it, you'll find not only was the display not manufacturable in the U.S., none of the components were manufactured in the U.S., and more specifically, the vast majority of the components could no longer be made in the U.S., even if they or the production technology was originally invented here. Okay, so that led to this paper that I co-authored with Gary Pisano, a colleague at HBS, titled Restoring American Competitiveness. And in that paper, we introduced the idea of the industrial commons, and we also put in my teardown analysis of the Amazon Kindle. Well, that paper got a lot of pickup because of the caption, America can't make a Kindle, right? And, you know, it really highlighted the problem with the whole designed in California, made in China thing. But once stories like America can't make a Kindle ran on CNBC and other media outlets, that paper got a lot of readership in Washington. It even made it into the president's economic briefing book, according to the Washington Post, and Gene Sperling, when he was head of the President's National Economic Council, started quoting from it a lot. You know, and that was all well and good, but then Harvard Business Publishing says, okay, you guys really need to do a book that explains all this stuff in more detail, and that's what led to this book, Producing Prosperity, Why America Needs a Manufacturing. But in the book, we really look into the questions of, you know, how mature is your production process, and whether you have what we call product process modularity. And we conclude that under some circumstances, it's really fine to do outsourcing and offshoring, and other circumstances where you really need to keep R&D close to production. And that's when you really need to be careful. The bottom line is when your process is not mature and you benefit from a lot of experimentation. You need to keep it close. If your product is not modular or your process is not the same, it's the same thing. But in many cases, it's fine. And that brings me to the last piece I promised you, an update on what I've been looking at more recently. I've been looking at this, at kind of the prospects for reshoring, something that there's been a lot of talk about these days. This belief is supported by a resurgence, I think, of the American auto manufacturers, as well as recent announcements by major American and global multinationals of their intention to source or manufacture in the United States. You know, Walmart recently announced it would increase its sourcing of domestically produced goods by $50 billion. Airbus broke ground on a narrow-body assembly facility in Alabama. Google's Motorola Mobility Unit, before they sold it, announced that it would assemble a smartphone in Texas. Apple announced it would produce a new high-end computer product in Texas. You know, so these, the question is, do these announcements signal a long-term shift in U.S. manufacturing competitiveness, and is the U.S. on a path to reindustrialization? I think a combination of factors is leading to what appears to be a resurgence. Foremost is what I call a rebalancing of the tradability equation, driven by comparative cost changes and what I would describe as kind of the end of labor arbitrage between the U.S. and China. Factory direct labor costs in China have been rising by 20 to 30% per year since 2006, while if you look at currency and inflation adjusted wages in the U.S., we've been relatively stagnant. So what might have been a 10x differential in the late 1990s or early 2000s is now only about 3x or maybe even less. According to the Boston Consulting Group, the labor cost advantage of China over a low-cost state like South Carolina or Alabama or Tennessee went from 55% advantage in 2011 to what they project as the 39% advantage next year in 2015. On top of that, if you look at the cost of shipping, it has risen dramatically with the price of oil. And a lot of companies are asking, is it still worth it? Equally important, I would say, have been gains in U.S. manufacturing productivity resulting from shop floor improvements and often dramatic restructurings, right? I mean, I think the U.S. auto industry proved once again what a unique restructuring tool bankruptcy is. They really wrote some new chapters in the book on that one. But finally, a return of consumer demand in industries like autos and lower energy costs, favorable policy interventions have markedly kind of changed the whole tone of investment in that sector. Nonetheless, I believe the resurgence is going to be very selective and concentrated in sectors like goods or industrial products where a firm might still have proprietary capabilities, or sectors where energy and things like petroleum-based feedstocks are a major component of the costs. So notwithstanding Google's and Apple's announcements, I do not believe we will see a return of large-scale electronics manufacturing, if only because the component supply chains are no longer here. What's been more problematic has been attrition of skills. So companies have changed their focus from design for manufacture and efficient assembly to low-cost competitive sourcing. They forgot how to do the basics of putting product into production offshore. I visited one of these high-profile reshoring factories. To get things going, the management team had to import automation engineers from Mexico. The more interesting thing is some of these factories have had a need to hire a lot of people to do assembly work, and they had a big problem with what I call job dropouts, people who, after coming on board and getting trained, find that the work is really not cut out for them. One of the managers told me, you know, we'd bring them in on Monday, train them for 2 days, put them on the line for two more days of training, and by Friday, you could stand by the trash can at the exit and see them throwing their badges in the trash on the way out. The good news, I think, is there's a change in thinking that's starting to take hold. I see more regions taking initiative and working with local industry to say, what can we do to help you grow your manufacturing base? Community colleges in some regions are reaching out to firms to provide training, and some big firms are taking it upon themselves to work on training people to develop long-term strategic relationships with suppliers It looks just like what China did when all this manufacturing started moving in there. So I actually think we're at a unique moment in the U.S. We have low energy costs compared to the rest of the world, particularly Europe. That's why we're seeing a lot of growth in manufacturing. BMW and Daimler both export 70% of what they made in the U.S. Honda now exports more from U.S. sites than they import from Japan. Volkswagen in Tennessee, Siemens in the Carolinas, Arriva in North Carolina. We're really very competitive compared to Europe, and a lot of that is energy and labor costs. So throughout this talk, I've really focused on tradability, the tradable sector, and unintended consequences of offshoring. In some sense, our notion of this industrial commons is the rediscovery of the importance of keeping production close to product development. And I think the thing that is new is highlighting the cross-sector applications. That's also the difficult thing, because if that capability doesn't matter to my industry, but it does to someone else, should I worry? That's why it's the tragedy of commons. But like I said in the last few minutes, I think there's a reason for some optimism. We're still the most innovative economy in the world and still the largest market. We have an environment of very favorable energy costs. We have the rule of law. The question in my mind is whether firms and regions, governments and institutions will recognize the opportunity at this point to rebuild the industrial commons in areas where it can be saved. That's certainly the opportunity.
More from Willie Shih in a minute as he takes questions from the audience. You're listening to the best of public radio from NHPR.